Hi everyone, thanks for tuning in. Towards the beginning of the year, Alan and I discussed the 1980 film American Gigolo, written and directed by Paul Schrader, and I was fortunate to speak with someone who could expand our conversation about some of the most central components of the film. Due to some technical difficulties, that interview was long delayed, and we weren't sure how or when to release it. With Paul Schrader's new film, The Card Counter, starring Oscar Isaac, now in theaters, we thought it would be the perfect opportunity to revisit American Gigolo and to share that interview with you before we launch Phase 2 of American Scene. Welcome back to American Scene, the show where we talk about movies with American in the title and what they have to say about American identity, culture, and values. To supplement our conversation about American Gigolo, I'm joined by a special guest to broaden our perspective of the sex trade and human trafficking in contemporary Los Angeles. Mary David is the director of communications for Journey Out. Mary, welcome. It's so great to speak to you. Can you tell us more about the organization and the work that you do?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Ben. As you mentioned, I am the director of communications at Journey Out, and Journey Out is a Los Angeles-based nonprofit serving victims and survivors of commercial sexual exploitation and sex trafficking, helping them live a life of abuse and violence, overcome their fears, and empower them to reach their full potential and achieve their goals. And we do that through a range of different services that we provide, from offering emergency to long-term housing, free clothing and food, job training, crisis response, court-approved diversion programming so clients can have prostitution charges dismissed from their record. We do street outreach on the tracks where victims are actually being exploited, and we offer clinical counseling, survivor mentorship. It really ranges, but basically a whole wheelhouse of services to really do everything we can to empower victims and survivors on their journey to freedom.
That's great. Yeah, it sounds like you really do it all.
Yes, I say we're small but mighty. You know, we have a small but extremely dedicated staff, and part of that, our passion stems from the fact that about half of our staff are survivors themselves, which is a really powerful message for our clients who walk through our doors, who know that the people that are actually in leadership roles and who are serving them and are in the day-to-day with them have actually walked in their shoes and know what it's like to be on their side of it. And so I think that model is really important and helps us just personalize the services that we provide and really give from our whole heart, but also, you know, just really elevate the importance of what leadership looks like and the incredible significance of having someone who is out on the other side when they are the change agents, just the ripple effects of that.
Brilliant. And you mentioned that you are LA-based. American Gigolo portrays a very specific version of Los Angeles. Of course, it takes place in the 70s, but it also takes place in exclusive clubs and restaurants, and the darker side of the city doesn't really play a big role. So my question for you is, what does Los Angeles in 2021 actually look like in the world of your work?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned in 2021 specifically, because particularly during COVID, even the nature of commercial sex and commercial sexual exploitation, like, it's just changed so dramatically with the pandemic in a lot of ways. You know, while previously, historically, it's been, you know, it's definitely been along the tracks all, you know, all over Los Angeles, but also, you know, in clubs. And now during the pandemic, there has been a shift to more webcamming. There are drive-by shows that happen, with hotels being limited in service that has increased the trafficking along the tracks, which are still, you know, have always been there and are starting to fill up again, you know, even more because now not having access to hotels and other places, we're also seeing certain demographic shifts in terms of even race and, you know, just different ethnic shifts in sort of the locations where trafficking hubs are.
Well, that's really interesting to see what's happening because of the pandemic. What were things like, I guess, pre-COVID? And where do you see the major differences between reality and what's portrayed in the movie? Because you did get a chance to watch the movie.
Yes, I did. Well, there are so many differences, the movie to what it's like in Los Angeles. I mean, the areas where you have victims, you know, out on the tracks, for example, I mean, that's the main location that, or a very popular destination or source, you know, for commercial sex is just out on, we call them the tracks, and that's basically just certain streets and parts of town where trafficking is just rampant, and you will just see lots of women, typically African American, very scantily clad. Sometimes they are being watched by their pimps from the sidelines, just, you know, tons of women and also people who look very young and potentially underage out there as well. And this can be, they certainly are also within very nice hotels as well. And so I think if anything, as far as the connection or similarity to what you saw in American Gigolo would be the very, very high end of what trafficking looks like, when in actuality in LA, the majority of trafficking it really is of African American women, at least the, you know, what we've seen so far. I think there are certainly more men and boys who are trafficked who were not seeing as many of the reports for that. Although we at Journey Out, you know, we do have some trans clients. We've had male clients that, you know, we've provided services to, but in terms of the bulk and of the clients that we serve, for example, about 89% of them are identify as Black or Indigenous people of color. And so that makes up a huge majority of trafficking in Los Angeles. They are a lot less economically stable than Julian was in the movie. I mean, you know, he was driving around in his Mercedes with fully stocked closets and ties, eating at nice restaurants. He has this, you know, glorious little bachelor pad in LA, which, you know, if anyone is familiar with rent in LA, I mean, that's a very prime, setup. And I think they had him at the Westwood Hotel, which, you know, that part of town would be a pretty penny. And the majority of clients are not coming from that same bracket economically at all. You know, they are just barely getting by. They're not able to take care of their families and feed their families the way that they would like to. They are really kind of at the mercy of their pimps and just, you know, lacking a lot of these niceties that that you saw portrayed in the film.
Yeah, and the kind of agency that he has to negotiate for himself.
Yes. I mean, the fact that he could decide whether he wanted to accept a client or not and what his off time was and what that looked like. I mean, the victims that are out there, they are out there working 7 days a week. It doesn't matter if it's snowing, if it's raining, if it's a pandemic. I mean, when the pandemic started, you know, A lot of them were just kind of unfazed at the beginning because literally they would say things like, well, I mean, either way, I am, you know, like I could be dead tomorrow. Like I'm worried about things like getting, you know, getting a knife or a gun pulled out on me every time I get into a car. So the fact that some, you know, mysterious virus might kill me in a few weeks, like I risk death every single time that I agree to a date, every vehicle, every person that I'm encountering out on the street multiple times a night. So so certainly all of that, the, you know, that sense of agency. But one interesting thing I will say about that and his sense of empowerment that I thought was interesting is, you know, you got a sense from him that he was calling the shots. But then at the end of the day, I really did appreciate when things were falling apart and, you know, forget her name, though, the woman that he was in love with. What was her name again?
Michelle.
So when she was trying to tell him that he should try to help him come up with other options to leave this. And he said, you know, it's all I'm good at. It doesn't matter. I can't quit. I need their protection. I mean, so many of those sentiments, I think, do resonate with people in commercial sexual exploitation, because a lot of them have been deprived of opportunities early on. I mean, the majority of them were exploited, whether it was officially on the tracks or by a family member or something like that, while they were minors. And so, or very early on in their life. And so they are missing all kinds of educational and social learning opportunities and truly don't know what it's like to operate in a world outside of that life. And so a lot of them feel like, I don't know what else can I do? I've never done anything else. I didn't go to college. I didn't graduate high school. I have nothing else to look forward to or nothing waiting for me. And so I did feel like that duality was kind of interesting.
That's an interesting moment to pick up on because it builds on an earlier scene when Michelle is asking Julian, you know, tell me everything about you. And he's pretty guarded. He's pretty defensive. And he says, you know, everything you want to know about me, you can find out, you know, in this bed, this is where I came from. And, you know, is he being guarded because of some past trauma, because there's something else there, or the question of, you know, how did he end up in this work? So I'd love for you to speak more on that and who are the kinds of people that you work with and where did they come from? You know, the LA setting, you know, did Julian come here because of some promise of fame or fortune or getting into film or TV or something like that? Yeah, anything you can share about that would be very interesting.
The majority of our clients, over 95% of them, have a history of child sexual abuse or incest. And so I think, you know, being exploited at some point in their life is a very common thread because it speaks to having physical boundaries crossed, a sense of normalcy in having sexual encounters that are in other respects, just have been unwanted or in some way triggering, and a situation where they were taken advantage of. I do think it's interesting that in the film he didn't. I mean, he was very guarded, and I think that's extremely common. I mean, so many of our clients, it is very difficult for them to have healthy romantic relationships after being in the life, because it's not the same way that Julian did struggle with dissociating work from his personal life. I mean, Michelle even said, you know, when you make love, you go to work. And I think that the conflict there is real, and it is tough for survivors to allow themselves, you know, to be vulnerable and to engage in relationships where they can feel safe, because so much of what they know is a sense of putting on a mask and being guarded. Because and so many times, I mean, they'll tell you, you know, if you show weakness, you will not survive. That leads to you getting killed on the street. You have to be tough. You have to be hard as nails. You can't let anybody in, because the second you crack is the second a pimp takes advantage of you. It's the second that another, you know, someone else on the street takes advantage of you. I mean, there's also a sense of competition, which I think you even, you know, you see elements of that in the film too, but that exists in the life for victims as well. You know, they really have to look out for themselves, because even with the same pimp, I mean, they're all fighting for that top space, which is ironically referred to as the closest, the one that's closest to the pimp is referred to as a bottom. The shorter version of what they're called is a bottom B, right, is what they're called. And that says, again, speaking to the degradation, right, the highest you can go is to be at the bottom. And that's the number two position. So bottoms are, you know, again, aggressively trying to protect that space. And anyone who's not a bottom is trying to get there. So I think the vulnerability piece really is a struggle.
That's really interesting. I would not have thought that there was so much depth to this film after my viewing of it and after my conversation with Alan. So I'm so glad for this conversation to kind of connecting relevant elements of the film to reality. The other part of this movie is law enforcement, and when Julian gets mixed up with this accusation that he's you know, this murder is getting pinned on him. Obviously, you must work in conjunction with law enforcement. What was your take on the portrayal of law enforcement in the film, and where do you feel have there been positive changes in relation to law enforcement and the sex trade?
In the film, Julian had such an interesting relationship with law enforcement here, because they were almost, I mean, they had a very friendly kind of back and forth. I mean, they were, the law enforcement was so forthcoming with him about the charges, you know, this is what evidence we have, this is what they didn't say against you, you know, when they said, well, they don't have your license plate, and she identified you in the lineup, but then she wasn't sure. I mean, they still didn't even charge him then, right? So, I mean, and they were very jovial. I think that in reality, there has historically been a lot of tension between law enforcement and victims, because oftentimes victims have been seen not as victims, and unfortunately they've been viewed as criminals oftentimes before there was really an understanding of what trafficking really entails and all of the manipulation and the coercion that goes into that. Thankfully, I think law enforcement as a whole has really worked to evolve and change their approach to be more victim-centered. One thing that we have at Journey Out is a crisis response. It's a law enforcement crisis response team. And so we have an emergency response group of case managers who actually are in the police stations, and they are the point person whenever LAPD comes across a potential victim, or if they have a big trafficking bust, and they let our team members know. And so then our crisis response team goes in and they can do an intake and really assess the situation and be that conduit between a victim and law enforcement to help build that sense of trust that you see sort of evidenced in the film, but I think historically has been less so. So that's definitely a positive stride that has been made in that connection. And certainly we just hope to keep building on that and to increase that information sharing so that victims really do get the services that they need and treated as victims and not as criminals. But I will say that one of the things that has been really great, and again, a change since the time of the movie, is the diversion program that we have at Journey Out actually enables anyone who has been charged with prostitution to come in, receive services with us for 8 to 12 or 18 weeks, and at the end of that, have charges dismissed from their records so that they don't have that holding them back and they're not being charged with the crime of prostitution. And that's just been a huge, huge step forward, and also has enabled so many victims to recognize that they are victims and then proceed and have a complete shift where they really can step into that, that process of healing and really claiming their survival and freedom and journey out of that life. We have so many clients who are, now completely out of the life and pursuing dreams that when they first started didn't even realize that they had, because like you saw with Julian saying, I just came from my bed and just didn't really have a sense of identity outside of that. They have really been able to look inward and reflect on what they really want out of life and just come full circle and now begin to embark on new career paths that are so fulfilling.
That's really encouraging. I'm really happy to hear that. The one last thing I want to talk about is specifically, we've been talking about the film American Gigolo, but it's not the only movie or work of entertainment that portrays the sex trade. I mean, there are any number of films and TV series. And I had mentioned in our episode, just the number, the sheer volume of entertainment and the fascination that it seems like creative people have with the sex trade. And in fact, of course, Richard Gere stars in another film, perhaps the most famous film featuring a sex worker, Pretty Woman. Are you attuned in any way to how film and TV portray this world? And how does that affect your work, or how does that relate to, things that you've had to deal with over the years?
Well, film and TV actually plays a tremendous role in our work. So often there are these misconceptions that are being filtered through this romantic lens that you see in the media. For example, with Pretty Woman that you referenced, there are so many women from Eastern Europe, for example, who have been trafficked because of pimps and traffickers using Pretty Woman as an example of what their life could really look like by running away with them, by engaging in prostitution and leaving their home, sometimes for the US, sometimes for other countries in Europe. But this dream idea of, wow, I could meet someone who then wants to marry me and we just have this beautiful fantasy life together. And it really is that. It's a fantasy. I mean, that's not the experience of what our clients go through. And it's so much more brutal than that. And it's the lifespan is so short for victims, and they don't see any of that. And they don't, there's no showcasing of that in media. Juries actually are influenced as well by movies. It's not just victims who you see embody these narratives and really take hold of them in terms of what juries are looking for when they are called in for a trafficking case, for example. Is they're looking for a victim that looks like what you have seen in Taken or other films. They're looking for someone who your heart really goes out to, who just seems so innocent, who has a squeaky clean background and was just caught up and swept into this thing. Often they assume that someone has been kidnapped or physically forced into it. And that's just not the face of most victims. Most victims have a prior record. They could have prostitution charges. They could have other charges. They often have drug charges because they've been self-medicating, trying to numb the pain. They often have a history in juvenile detention. They will be combative at times. They are the highest risk in some ways to a trafficking case because if they are, for example, still in love with their trafficker or are in fear of their trafficker, then they can be extremely unreliable when it comes to having them come in to testify. And all of those elements just do not play well in the courtroom, particularly to a jury who is not well-versed in just what the after effects of trauma looks like. Trafficking is an extreme complex trauma where you have, you know, all of these different issues that are feeding into one another, whether it be, you know, again, coming from a troubled family background. A lot of trafficking victims are in and out of foster care. There are huge ties between foster care and trafficking and you know, people who've been homeless and who have had to be really rough and tough and out on the street. And that often works against them in a trial. And so the more we can showcase more realistic portrayals and also just educate people to what those nuances and those differences are between what's shown in the media versus what trafficking really looks like, the better it's going to be, and just the justice that's replicating on a much larger scale is, you know, something that I feel like is immeasurable. And so I'm so glad that you are doing this podcast and just really raising awareness about these different nuances and what we should be aware of when we're looking at a film versus looking at real life.
Well, I owe any credit that you want to give to me. I owe it to you for engaging with me in this conversation. It's been very enlightening. It's been eye-opening. And I certainly hope that, that people do educate themselves more and don't assume that any version of their entertainment is giving them the real truth about what's going on out there for victims. Is there anything else that you'd like to share, or if people are in need or want to seek you out, want to seek out Journey Out, where should they go?
Anyone who would love more information about human trafficking or our work with victims and survivors, I would love to connect with you. Our social media is at Journey Out LA. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And we are also online just via our website, which is www.journeyout.org. We have a lot of different programs. We do a lot of prevention programming with youth. And I am so excited for just continuing to expand awareness and outreach. So feel free to forward any questions or training opportunities or anything our way. It would be our pleasure.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, Mary.
Thank you so much for having me, Ben.
Thank you so much for listening. If you like what we're doing, please give us a rating, leave a positive review. You can give us your unfiltered opinion on Twitter at @AmericanScene_. And if you'd like to follow either of your patriotic co-hosts, I'm Ben Rosen on Twitter at @NotThatBenRosen.
I'm Alan Austin at @Alan_Austin_.
And we'll see you next time.